Good afternoon, Henry.
Hi, Mark. How are you doing?
Very well. How are you?
Not too bad. Not too bad. Enjoying the good weather.
Beautiful afternoon.
So I've
created this thing where I told Bob Wright that I thought the dueling mugs should be a Blogging Heads trademark, just because I showed off this mug I had when I did this with John Chait a couple weeks ago, and then some others followed us. So I've tried to make this an ongoing thing. So what do you got?
Well, what I've got is not that impressive, I think. It's a mug which I'm holding up to the camera. You have to read backwards, I guess. It says, "Hands off my coffee." And it's a picture of a pig. It's a mug that I designed on Cafe Press for my wife, who collects things with pigs on them. So that's the story. But I understand you've got a more impressive
mug. You don't have Crooked Timber memorabilia on Cafe Press?
We actually don't. I think that Esther developed some at some stage, and I've always meant to get something done. She has a bumper sticker, a Crooked Timber bumper sticker that she did for her car, but I've never quite gotten around to it.
You should put on a mug. We should get a mug. She once did, I think it was Esther, did a project on how many, like, right-wing bloggers and left-wing bloggers link to each other versus just link across ideology as opposed to just linking among themselves.
Yeah, that's right.
She actually had my dying blog on there, and it was so far out there on the left corner, it was really terrible. But I think it was partly because I don't really link to very many people, because I don't think I'm the most ideologically isolated guy out there in the blogosphere, but maybe I am.
No, absolutely not. I remember you muttering about how you had to update your blog role one of these days real soon, about 2 or 3 years back.
I don't know if you ever heard. I think I've decided to be more of a parasite on other people's blogs than maintain my own.
Well, it makes sense. Given your blogging, it seems to me that a lot of your blog posts were basically miniature essays disguising themselves as blog posts.
Yeah.
And now that you're doing a lot for the Washington Monthly and the American Prospect, it probably makes sense to develop them as real essays.
It might as well do it that way. I think the tragedy about giving it up is that I will never come up with a better name for something than the name I came up with for my blog, which is The Decembrist. And I think yours, you probably feel the same way about Crooked Timber.
Crooked Timber actually was a decision we made by committee, and I don't think any of us was super enthused by it so much as it was the alternative that none of us objected to strenuously. So I guess that's how it came about.
So the mug I have, which is I'm not drinking from it because it's the afternoon, I'm not drinking coffee, and plus this mug has actually been holding pens for about 5 or 6 years, so would require a strenuous cleaning, is from the Richard Nixon Library and Birthplace in California. And on the back it says, "Only if you have been in the deepest valley can you ever know how magnificent it is to be on the highest mountain." And it's got Richard Nixon's signature underneath. Have you ever been to the Nixon Library?
That I have not, but I have received a check from them.
Yeah, so you are part of that.
I've been bought off. They brought me in for a Nixon Center conference. I don't think they realized I was a lefty and were... Let's just say that I haven't received any invites to go back there since.
I think the Nixon Center is actually more legitimate than the Nixon Library. I mean, my colleague Steve Clemens worked at the Nixon Center at one time. The Nixon Library is more of a, almost like a Graceland-type tribute to the man, the myth. And it has no, it's not a government library like the LBJ Library or the Kennedy Library, so it has no, you know, no obligation to historical accuracy or anything else. There's one great room where there are these giant bronze statues of all the great leaders that Nixon interacted with. And if you're in that room, the docent will come up to you and say, you know, have you been informed that they're life-size? Which they're not only life-size, they're a little more than life-size. There's the biggest one is de Gaulle, who is literally the size of Shaquille O'Neal in pure bronze. So speaking of de Gaulle, I think one of the things we wanted to talk about was the successor to de Gaulle, the successor to Churchill, some of the things that are going on in European politics. I'm going to try to get my get out of my usual politics stops at the water's edge rut and try to understand the world a little bit better here.
Well, yeah, no, there's a lot of stuff. You've commented occasionally on the French elections, which are coming up in a couple of months. And it's pretty interesting. We've seen French politics is usually pretty divided. The right and the left are both pretty splintered. Both of them have come up with pretty coherent platforms, despite themselves, I think, around two candidates who aren't typical French candidates, Sarkozy on the right and Ségolène Royal on the left, and it's a pretty interesting race.
Right. I think I only mentioned it because I've just had this, I've had this kind of crush on Ségolène Royal for a year or so now. I think I'm like most of France. I didn't really know what she stood for, and I didn't really want to know. and she's certainly, but she's doing sort of amazing things in a sense. It's kind of like the sort of triangulation that one would expect from the one associates, say, with the Clintons, but with a sort of grace and freshness about it that's quite remarkable. I mean, she's really, I think, trying to connect to people's concerns about family life and the sort of shape of their culture in a way that socialist parties in Europe never did, which were really totally based on materialist politics and just a totally different approach, although quite vague at the same time. And that's obviously what she's now running up against is the problem of the sort of generality and vagueness of her approach. But you know, the idea, it would be in either case, certainly I think to a greater degree if it's Royale, it's just a total fresh start, and it's very much similar to, I think, what's the appeal to a lot of people of Barack Obama, a sense of, you know, we're starting this whole thing fresh. You know, this is the kind of person you've never seen before in this kind of position. And I think that in itself, I never found that as appealing as I do right now, I think.
Well, I think that's right. And I think that I go one step further than that even, which is that French politics is extraordinarily dominated by elites. You know, so basically, most French politicians, maybe Jacques Delors, who went on to Brussels as the most prominent exception I can think of off the top of my head, most prominent French politicians have gone to the École Nationale d'Administration, the big school for elites, and have gone to Sciences Po before. And you know, so you still get things where 20 or 30 years after these people have graduated, they still remember that this politician came fifth in his class and this politician came 12th. So on the one hand, it's admission to these schools has been on the basis of competitive examinations, and there's been a little bit of openness and give because of that. But on the other hand, these have led to a very tightly interlocked elite, which is really pretty unrepresentative in some ways of French society, and which is pretty incestuous. And what I think Royale, who's in sort of midway out of this elite, is trying to do, is trying to sort of come up with something which is a politics which is more connected to the people out there. And also in a weird way, Sarkozy is trying to do the same. I think he's a pretty interesting, pretty conflicted figure. I'm reading at the moment the draft of Rick Perlstein's forthcoming book on the Nixon era.
Oh, you're a lucky man.
It's pretty interesting. It's pretty fun. But in some ways, Sarkozy reminds me of Nixon. You know, so there's a lot of the same kinds of hang-ups and resentments, distrust and dislike of the elite that he nonetheless wants to be a part of, and a lot of the same sort of ideological flexibility, you know, sort of making use of sort of anti-Arab racism in the way that he did with his famous comment about how he'd basically like to hose the streets of the scum who were rioting out there during the riots a couple of years ago. But also, sort of very clearly cutting his claws to suit his measure, he made a speech a few days ago in which he basically went back on a couple of the major foreign policy and domestic policy positions that he'd had, clearly trying to soften his image, clearly trying to do whatever was necessary to get elected. So this weird kind of mixture of a certain kind of opportunism, a certain kind of resentment, a feeling of being from outside the elite but wanting to be part of the elite, and a very complicated, interesting, weird personal biography.
Yeah, that's interesting. That sort of reminds me, I'm very much looking forward to the Perlstein book. I think that's very similar to the picture of Nixon in Gary Wills' Nixon Agonistes, which I think is one of the greatest books about ever written about American politics, which, you know, is just kind of the crisis of the self-made man as the subtitle, and what it is to sort of be this, you know, incredibly striving out of the elite in a place and time where that elite represented, you know, in particular by the Kennedys, was so much in the ascent. Royal, on the other hand, has that background. She has the classic background, but kind of understands how to work around it a little bit and what's insufficient about it, I think. I mean,
well, she comes, as far as I remember, her background, yeah, a lot of her background is like that, but she also comes from a sort of a petty bourgeois family. Her father was a pretty strict military officer.
Right. She was born in Senegal, right?
Yeah. She's a very strange and very interesting mix. But the fact that she and Sarkozy are basically duking it out suggests that the elite is losing its grip, I think, on French politics, because very clearly there was a very concerted attempt on the left and among the opinion-forming classes in France to exclude Royale at an early stage from the presidential running. One of France's best-known political journalists wrote a bestseller which was about the potential candidates for the presidency, and specifically, and I think deliberately, did not mention Royale. So the fact that she's gotten this far, regardless of or not of whether she actually makes it the full way, suggests that something interesting is beginning to change in France.
Yeah, for sure. That'll be fascinating to watch and try to pay attention to. I noticed something today that she was, even though she's sagging a little bit, she apparently has remarkable appeal in some of the more conservative areas. And they were quoting someone, this was in the FT this morning, quoting somebody from an area that often goes heavily for the National Front. And the guy was saying, you know, we are former Cade Mar from Algeria. We're the most conservative people there are. But this is something different and we're looking for it. Similar, a little of that attempt to sort of use a kind of populism to bridge the way back, I guess, to a little more of a liberal vision.
Yeah, and the I read the same FT article that you did, and the undertone that I got from that FT article, which I think was intended, was that a lot of the talk about whether or not she's losing out in the presidential election is chatter among the Parisian elite. And if you actually go to the provinces, it's here that she's managing to attract the attention and to some degree the adulation, basically, I think, of people who feel that they are being left out by the system. Clearly, Sarkozy is also trying to appeal to some of that same kind of feeling. But the interesting question for me is how far he's going to be able to get, because he's got a somewhat tricky balancing act to pull off here. On the one hand, he's clearly going to want to, he's got a natural need to try and attack to the right, because presumably the National Front are going to mount another presidential challenge, which is going to bleed off a considerable percentage of the right-wing vote. So he wants to try and hoover up as much of those votes as he can. But he also, in order to try and beat Royale at her own game, he's clearly been trying to soften and to blur his image and to make himself seem like a more warm, more human kind of figure. And it's pretty hard to do both of those at once. So it's going to be, I'm not on the ground, so I can't predict who's going to win, who's going to lose, but the dynamics are pretty interesting.
Right. Well, that's fascinating. And then I've always been interested in the UK, and particularly that transition in UK politics between Blair and Brown, which it seems to, it was always very promising, because I thought Brown had, you know, much more substantive vision of what Labour could really be, not just in a moral sense, but really a very positive social vision. But unfortunately, I think it's become a soap opera a long time ago, and people are eager to just either get on with it. And I think by the time they actually get on with the transition, people will be, Brown will have a very short honeymoon in which to put forward any kind of real vision. On top of which, the Tories are rapidly moving in a direction similar to the way Blair moved 10 years ago.
Yeah, well, the Tories, in some ways, Labour have had a... they've had an extended honeymoon because the Tories have not been able to get their act together ever since Blair won the first time. They've gone for an increasingly weird and increasingly unattractive list of leaders, and clearly at this stage they're pretty desperate to get back in. I think I agree with you fundamentally on Brown, that he is a... he's a more substantial, he's a more interesting... a more complicated and enigmatic figure in some ways than Blair is, but also somebody who I think has more substance to him. And certainly my friends who are sort of on the left of the British Labour Party have been sort of agitating for Brown leadership for quite some time and are hopeful of what's going to happen. But it's going to be very, very tough for him precisely because of the forces that you mentioned, because an election is going to be coming up pretty quickly, so within, 2 years, 2 years maximum after he becomes Prime Minister. And it's going to be, and unless he wins that election, clearly he's not going to have all that much of an opportunity to put his stamp on British politics. But one interesting straw in the wind, which I guess moves us nicely to the next topic we want to talk about, was his trip to India, which threatened to be overshadowed by this controversy over Celebrity Big Brother, and where Brown seems to have succeeded pretty well in diffusing that and in moving pretty nattily on his feet in order to turn what could have been one of these controversies that blew out of nowhere into something that didn't become the major threat that it could have been.
Right. Well, it is a reminder of how unforeseeable everything in politics is. You think you know what your issues are, and then something crazy from a celebrity reality show takes over. And I don't know how much people have followed this. I just started. Somebody sent me an email yesterday, so I sort of looked into this. We'll have a discussion about something I know in complete ignorance. I know nothing about who any of these people are. I've never watched Big Brother. The only reality show I've ever watched was Project Runway. But in the UK, apparently, in Celebrity Big Brother, they have a group of people living kind of in isolation in a house who are celebrities, although I've never heard of them. One of them is a Bollywood star, and she's apparently been subjected to all kinds of racist remarks by other so-called celebrities in the house. And I saw something, what I saw yesterday, what somebody sent me a link to, was a statement by the friends of one of the other celebrities, in which they said, defended her against all these charges of racism, and said, at one point apparently this woman said to the Bollywood star, whose name is Shilpa Shetty, said to Shilpa Shetty, now, is it India where you all eat with your hands, or is that China? I can't remember which it is. And her friend defended her in the statement by saying, when she asked, is it India or China where you all eat with your hands, it was certainly not meant as a racist remark. It was simply curiosity about the different, cuisines and habits of these two countries. And the rest went on like that. It's gotten very, very bitter, and there have been, in India, where Brown is, there's they burned an effigy of the producers of the Celebrity Big Brother show. So this has suddenly turned into quite the event.
Yeah, which as you say, it's the old Harold Macmillan, I think, the events, my dear boy, events thing.
Right.
But it's also pretty interesting. A couple of pieces of background which might be useful. Last time I was on Blogging Heads, I referred to all of us as being F-list celebrities. And the typical inhabitants of Celebrity Big Brother, they're not quite F-list, they're C-list celebrities. They're mostly people on their way down or who are desperately trying to flag media careers of one sort or another.
Yeah.
And I think that the sort of most prominent, perhaps previous inhabitant of Celebrity Big Brother was George Galloway, he didn't last all that long.
He must be a little annoyed that he didn't manage to create the most actual attention for Big Brother.
No, he's clearly been completely outclassed by this. I was reading the Financial Times blog this morning, and they said that this was that their article on this was one of the most popular articles on their website, and I think kind of eclipsed the usual kinds of stuff like, you know, so whether or not the Bank of Japan is holding its interest rates or not, which
right.
are the kinds of bread and butter issues that FT readers usually go for.
Right.
Everybody wanted to find out what was happening with Big Brother, and what
right.
was the story behind this.
Right. And of course, they couldn't write about it until they actually technically had a business angle, which was some sponsor actually being pressured to pull their ads from the show after there were 38,000 complaints.
And actually having had pulled, I think that sponsor has pulled their ads
yeah.
from the show.
Yeah.
And there's also a lot of muttering. Channel 4, which broadcasts Celebrity Big Brother, was originally set up as a sort of minority taste channel to provide all of the sort of weird and interesting avant-garde stuff that BBC 1 and 2 weren't capable of providing. And over the last 5 or 10 years, it's gone increasingly down market with a lot of soap operas, a lot of Big Brother-type TV shows. And so the question that politicians are asking is whether or not public money should be going to fund this kind of stuff or whether it shouldn't.
Right.
So,
and we all believe that everything on British TV is high-minded and serious. But it's an interesting, and it does, I guess, force the UK to really confront some of the issues of race and racism, and that's interesting because one of the things that David Cameron has done as the new Tory leader is kind of very aggressively pull his party away from the. From the xenophobia that characterized it at certain, you know, the rivers of blood kind of dimension that it had, and much more clearly embraced the multi-ethnic England.
Yeah, that certainly is true. If you went back, I think it was the last election campaign. I think when the Conservatives were running an ad about crime, which had some. I don't think it was quite Willie Horton stuff, but it certainly sort of was giving the impression that the criminals were sort of not common, decent white English folk. And the subtext text that sort of was at the end of each of these advertisements was, "Are you thinking what we're thinking?"
Right.
And the subtext of that wasn't exactly difficult to read. So
right.
this stuff backfired spectacularly, and the Tories, I think, became known as the nasty party. And clearly Cameron is trying to make them sound warmer and fuzzier, more multi-ethnic. That
right.
said, he's going to have his work cut out for him because the average Tory party member is, last time I checked, I think the average Tory member was something like 68 years old or something quite extraordinary. And clearly they tend to be very much the Blue Rinse Brigade and sort of old, pretty set
right.
in their ways, not necessarily all that happy with the
right.
new multi-ethnic Britain that's emerging. So he's managed to pull it off to date, I think, primarily because the Conservatives are so desperate to win at this stage that they're prepared to go with more or less anything that...
But actual party members is different from party voters. Like, I think there are many fewer Labour Party members than there used to be.
Yeah, that's true.
As I understand it, and they're probably much older as well. There's something about, you know, as here, I think, membership, the nature of membership has changed.
The nature, yeah, well, there are two things going on. One is, as you say, a secular change, which is that parties have moved from being the sort of mass membership organizations that they used to be into being sort of into having far fewer members and relying on those members much less, relying on things like TV advertising and whatever to get the message out in the way that they didn't used to. But the second thing is that there is, as far as I remember, British Labour Party membership has been shrinking dramatically over the last 10 or 15 years. It hadn't, at least the last time I checked this, which was a couple of years ago, shrunk as much as the Conservative membership had shrunk. And also the British Labour Party members, while they were pretty clearly of the older generation, weren't quite as geriatric as the British Conservative parties were. And where this comes into play, I think, is crucially in the area of candidate selection. Now, I know that Cameron has been trying, as indeed have other party leaders before him, has been trying to effectively remove as much of the element of choice from local constituency organizations over who becomes a candidate and who doesn't as possible to try and parachute in some candidates who will freshen things up a little bit. Yeah. But the extent to which he succeeded, I'm not sure.
You know, I'm really interested. I have some thoughts about this whole idea of the change in the nature of membership, and you look at, you know, in the U.S., all our... We used to do so much politics through these large direct mail organizations, whether it's, you know, Sierra Club or NARAL, and all of those in the same way have their membership is the people who send $40, let's say, is shrinking and old. Not the individuals may not be shrinking, but the number of members is shrinking. My sense is that a lot of what we typically characterize as internet-based political activity, but I don't think that's really the key characteristic of it. But things that are much more transactional, and you can, you know, you don't throw your loyalty into any place for your life as this is my issue. You kind of move around and you engage in a lot of different kinds of political transactions, express your views in different ways, connect in different ways. That in some ways that's related to the netroots, and that change how we engage in politics is going to have huge consequences. You've written a lot about this in your wonderful article in the Boston Review about the netroots. And then over on TPM Cafe, Josh Marshall got this discussion started with an essay by Matt Stoller, which got some very vigorous reaction. And then I jumped in to take a swipe at the baby boomers, because of course I'm no baby boomer myself.
You shouldn't underdo yourself in this, because a lot of my thinking on this, I guess we shouldn't slap each other's backs too much, but you wrote a blog post a couple of years ago, Kosa's Penguin and Political Organization, which I assigned to my students each semester that I teach.
You,
on the
seriously?
Yeah,
oh, excellent.
Seriously.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah. No, it's a...
I didn't see that on your syllabus that you posted the other day on Crooked Timber.
No, that's a different class.
That's a different course. That looked like an amazing, you know, that your syllabus made me think, could I be like Rodney Dangerfield, you know, and, you know, re-enroll in college just to take Henry's course?
Well, if you want
political institutions, there's a lot of stuff there that I should have read or should read.
Yeah, but if you want to sneak in, I'm sure we can turn a blind eye.
We'll sneak in, as a...
But yeah, no, there's definitely something, I think... If you go back to the people and hear the political science wonkery part of me comes out, because if people talk about different ages of party organization, which is, you used to have mass membership parties until the 50s or 60s, and sort of ever since then, mass membership parties have been declining, and instead you've been having parties putting much less emphasis on trying to recruit members, on trying to work through members, and much more on mass media of one sort or another. Basically, as soon as people begin to figure out TV advertising, they move into a new phase. But I think what your post has made me think is that we're moving into a sort of a third and quite different phase of organization, where effectively you get, as you say, these people basically signing on to a cause for a short period of time. And here, I think the perfect example of this is Josh Marshall. When Josh Marshall and a couple of other people got riled up about Sinclair Communications and what Sinclair Communications was doing, suddenly, some guy comes up with a website which seeks to identify the various people who advertise on Sinclair Communications local television stations.
This was when Sinclair was running that anti-Kerry...
The anti-Kerry thing just before the election.
Pseudo-news program. Yeah.
Yeah, and so you get this massive, effectively this grassroots campaign coming out of nowhere in the space of 48, 72 hours. Somebody organizes a website who says that Pepsi advertises on this local affiliate. Here is the sort of contact email for Pepsi. And tens of thousands of people actually sort of start writing to Pepsi and start doing stuff. And the campaign it disappears almost as quickly as it appears after Sinclair effectively appeared to back down after their stock price begins to plummet. But that, to me, I think is a perfect example of this kind of more transitory kind of political arrangement that you identified, I think, a year and a half before or 2 years or whenever you wrote that blog post. Effectively, that we're getting these campaigns, you know, sort of appearing out of nowhere and then evaporating as quickly again when their apparent purpose has been exhausted, rather than the sort of steady, long-term membership organizations that have been more traditional.
Right, right. So, in the what was your impression of the debate on TPM Cafe?
Well, I think that the debate was more heat than light. I look at and I like Max Sawicki a lot. He's a super smart, super nice guy who has many, many, many interesting things to say. But I think that his sort of characterization, especially when he says that these are basically a bunch of brainless guys who who function as vacuum cleaners for funding, I think that's not only out of line, but it's incredibly inaccurate. And I think that what you pointed to, when you talk about the way that Fire Dog Lake and other people organize these book clubs, there's real discussion going on there. There's real debate. There's also there's also a lot of junk, a lot of garbage, a lot of name calling. But 90% of everything, of every form of discussion that has been invented, is garbage, and the stuff which is good is really very, very good indeed. That said, I wasn't particularly impressed either with Marcus's response that, if all of you Marx readers are the people who brought us Reagan and Bush and whatever, which I thought, Marcus is smarter than that. That I didn't think was an especially useful or smart characterization either. And it's interesting to me that this division between the blogosphere and wonkosphere has suddenly come to the fore. You wrote a piece in the American Prospect about it a couple of months ago, how both the intellectual type bloggers, the ones who consider themselves more interested in policy, and the ones who are more interested in sort of nitty-gritty politics, really have a lot to say to each other and should work together more. And I think that's right, but it's also clear that there's a lot of mutual distrust. Where that mutual distrust comes from, I'm not quite sure, but there's there's definitely weird animosity developing there.
Yeah, there really are. Well, there's and sometimes they get resolved too. I mean, I once got attacked on Daily Kos, and then for being what's the term? The term they use is like sensible centrist, sensible left centrist, or something like that, which is a term of which
utter
is
disrespect.
Not a kind of thing to say. It was not meant kindly. But then they sort of acknowledged that no, I was kind of part of the movement too, and that was okay. And of course, everybody has a different role to play. And there's a recognition of it at the same time that sometimes this kind of nastiness comes out. I mean, I'd written that partly in response to your essay in Boston Review because I thought you sort of treated it all as an activist movement and didn't have as much to say about the wonkosphere dimension. And, especially, I mean, Matt Stoller does this comparison with the New Left. Well, the whole story of New Left and the late 60s and all this stuff, which he got attacked for not knowing all the different factions exactly of that time, which seems a little ridiculous. But the story of that time was really of a real breakdown of understanding between liberals and this new left and people who even though they were both against the Vietnam War, one still had basic trust in American institutions and came out of that liberal tradition, and the other was ready to go to the barricades and bring everything down. And that was a real breach of understanding. That was a real breakdown. And compared to which, I think, blogosphere, wonkosphere, we could deal with this one.
Well, this is something which is really coming home to me reading Perlstein's book. As I say, I'm not American, I'm Irish. So a lot of my exposure to this stuff has been secondhand. And, frankly, the people complain about the state of political discourse and whatever today. If you read what was going on in the 60s both sides of the spectrum, accusations of communist and fifth columnism and whatever on the right, and the various stuff that was happening around Stokely Carmichael on the left, who seems to have been a smart and sincere but utterly misguided guy. We're actually in much better shape than maybe people realize.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think there's really a lot of a lot. And the interesting thing about Netroots, it is this continual conversation, as much as it melts down every once in a while, it's kind of like if you're talking to each other constantly, you're going to have moments where it just flares up into some kind of crazy argument, and then hopefully gets back down to something where there's a little more understanding. I think it's kind of an amazing experience.
Well, there's one other empirical thing. I've got to go back and check this to make sure. But you mentioned Esther having written this thing on the blogosphere and mapping out the blogosphere.
Right.
This is actually sort of one part of that is going to go into a chapter for a book that Dan Dresner and I are writing. Yeah. And as far as I remember, Esther specifically notes that she doesn't find any coherent subgroups which really can be identified as specific separate communities on either the left or the right of the political spectrum. So I need to go back and check that to make sure that's exactly what she says. But if that's accurate, it would suggest that maybe some of the argument about there being these two separated hemispheres of the two separated camps on the left-wing side may be a little overstated, or at least may sort of not actually appear in the actual data when you look at the ways in which people link to each other and don't link to each other, that maybe the arguments and the exchange between the wonkosphere and the Netroots, or however else you would like to define it, is actually a little more open than people might seem to think from the...
I think that's my subjective view, and then I don't know whether, does linking represent listening? maybe is another question, but that would be interesting to see. And we should put links to these things on the.
I don't think that's available online yet, unfortunately.
Okay.
But we'll
link to the original.
Yeah, yeah.
Great little chart where you can see just how insular I am. Let's talk. You just did a post today, which I thought was terrific, and doing more free advertising to the Financial Times, where my wife used to work. You did an article linking to this great essay about the whole question of pundits who were right or wrong about Iraq and how they should be treated, and this great essay arguing that the biggest problem was that they were all journalists and they were taught in this manner to simplify and exaggerate and to denigrate the idea of actual deep knowledge about the subject, which is almost inherent in the definition of the idea of being a pundit. You sort of are able to sort of prognosticate broadly on whatever topic comes up, as I just did on French politics, for example, and that's actually valued more highly than that somebody might actually know something about French politics other than reading a few newspaper articles about it. Let's say a little bit more about that, and then get into this question. It's sort of a funny thing that all of a sudden this question has flared up in this particular moment, I wonder what your idea is of why that is. All of a sudden, this question has flared up of who was wrong or right about the Iraq War in 2002, 2003, and why, and what the consequences should be. And I want to get in on this too. I last time I did this with John Chait, he's written a column about that, and I feel like I should have been a little harsher at the time. So I'll do the ex post facto stab in the back here.
Yeah, well, I think my take on it, I guess, is broadly ecumenical, which is that clearly people can get things wrong, people can make fundamental mistakes, and still can be worth listening to. But I also think that there has to be some sort of mechanism for accountability there, something whereby people admit that they screwed up, and also sort of really think through what this means for their fundamental beliefs, their fundamental suppositions about the way that the world works. And I'm kind of reminded, and this is maybe a goofy academic analogy here, but Thomas Kuhn's work on the structure of scientific revolutions, where he basically talks about people and their paradigms, you know, sort of scientists and their paradigms, and how the, you know, you advance by a sort of working within a paradigm until you realize that this paradigm, that there's more stuff that can't be explained by it that can, that fundamental parts of it have been shown to be false, and then you move on to something else. And he holds this out as being a kind of ideal of how the scientific process of discovery works under the best possible circumstances. And I think that's a kind of, it's an ideal to hold out. It's a very hard ideal to live up to. I sometimes think, okay, what would have happened? I was one of the people who thought this was going to be a disaster from the start. What would have happened if the Iraq War had instead turned out to be an incredible success, had managed to do sort of not necessarily all of the stuff that people had hoped that it would do, but nonetheless it managed at the very least to create some sort of a stable and relatively decent society within Iraq, which was substantially better than the dictatorship that had preceded it. And I hope that under those circumstances I would have been forced not only to admit that I was wrong in the specifics, that the sort of some of the people who I disagreed with were correct, but that it would force me to reevaluate some of the fundamental assumptions that I had come into the debate with, and to learn from that. You know, so the old sort of Keynes remark here, you know, so when I discover I'm wrong, or however it goes, on the facts, I change my mind. What do you do, sir?
Right.
And for me, the division isn't necessarily between the people who are right and who are wrong, because, you know, so the fact that people who are wrong should cause them to reevaluate their ideas, but it's more the people who refuse to admit, or who only admit in a relatively weaselly kind of way that they were wrong in this, and say, well, their opponents were wrong too, they were only right by accident.
Right.
And maybe there's something to that in some cases, but when you're wrong on something this major, this important, this fundamental, it should prompt you to re-examine fundamentally the ideas that brought you to this point, not necessarily to abandon them completely, but at least to to update them, to use
right.
a term from statistics, and to think, okay, maybe the world isn't working quite the way that I thought that it did.
Right. Well, you, at the very least, you have to be willing to do that and not throw out the straw man of, you know, well, some people who were wrong about Iraq were basically people who were, maybe they also opposed the war in Afghanistan, or they pretty much oppose any war. They may not be total pacifists, but they're pretty damn close. Well, that kind of person isn't necessarily the most subtle guide to the pragmatic questions of war and peace. But there are plenty of other people who, while being a little more cold-blooded about it, were quite vigorously opposed the war, quite a lot of people. But the other thing is, of course, it's not, you know, even if it had turned out fine, that doesn't necessarily mean you were completely wrong in all the things that you thought about it. Example I always use about this is, when I worked on Capitol Hill, I did a lot of work on welfare reform in the mid-1990s. And, I did a lot of stuff to try to make it better. I thought it was a bad bill. My boss voted against it. I was quite vigorous in my belief that it put people at risk in a way that was unnecessary. As it turned out, because it went into a booming economy, it turned out quite well, in fact. And there's a lot, not a lot that didn't turn out that well, but a lot more people, you know, moved into the workforce and so forth. In many ways, I was wrong about welfare reform. And there's some specific things that I was definitely wrong about, how easy or hard it would be to kind of change the bureaucracy and things like that. But on the whole, you know, I always have this line that I say, you know, it was a big gamble on how the economy would turn out. And the fact is, if you bet your kid's college fund on the New England Patriots to win the AFC Championship, and the New England Patriots do win the AFC Championship, it doesn't make you a good parent. You know, you still shouldn't take irresponsible chances. And it was pretty easy to, if somebody said, you know, the odds of Iraq or of an invasion of Iraq are 45%, that it turns out, you know, roughly the way it did, we can never extricate ourselves, nothing, you know, of great value as game. We just, you know, if there was a 45% chance of this outcome, it would probably still have been a bad idea. You know, if there was a 55% chance of the yeah. sort of good scenario that you painted, and a 45% chance of the other, it might still be a terrible idea. So the results don't necessarily always vindicate somebody being wrong or right, and that's why it is important. You know, does somebody actually bring some knowledge to this thing or not? You know, I mean, Juan Cole is right because Juan Cole knows a lot. Somebody who, some, you know, random pundit who was against the war but brings absolutely no knowledge to it, that person isn't necessarily, I wouldn't necessarily say, okay, that person should then replace, you know, Tom Friedman.
Well, I think there are a couple of things. You know, first of all, the welfare reform. I think one nice book here, which you probably have read, I would guess, is Jason DeParle's book from a couple of years back,
right.
Which I think is pretty interesting on how, you know, the debates over welfare reform between the left and the right actually didn't impact all that much on sort of the real way in which welfare and sort of people on welfare actually lived their lives, actually coped or didn't cope. So that on the one hand, as you say, sort of people like you who had thought that there was going to be some major disaster turned out to be wrong. But on the other hand, people who thought that this was going to be some sort of a Thatcherite and sort of Reaganite and sort of Jack Kemp kind of dream where we would have all of these people suddenly rediscovering themselves and rediscovering their individual vigor and sort of get to work kind of whatever, that clearly hasn't
right.
happened either.
Right.
You know, so, and this is, I think, a fundamental problem for intellectual talking heads like, you know, frankly, like you and me, that we have to, you know, so that it's so easy to get wrapped up in the debates and wrapped up in, you know, sort of the intellectual debates about this and not to pay as much attention to what's actually happening on the ground and what the implications
right.
of that should
right.
be for our arguments. And
right.
I think that something like this, you know, sort of squared or cubed, is what happened with the sort of debate over the Iraq War. And on the other point, as you say, you know, so the fact that you turn out to be wrong in Instant X does not mean that you know, sort of in fact are wrong overall. You know, so this could just be a lucky whatever. But then I think what you want to do is you want to draw an analogy from statistics, from Bayesian statistics, which is to say that you update your beliefs about the sort of state of the world that you're in. You know, so that you think, okay, well, I am sort of, it may be that my fundamental presuppositions are correct, but the sort of percentage chance that I was correct in that has
right.
sort of decreased to some extent. And clearly, this is something which is kind of, it's hard for people to do. People love their ideological preconceptions. It's extremely hard for people to give them up. And to go back to science and the story about paradigm shift, I can't remember whether it was Kuhn or somebody else, you know, the famous statement that the progress of science advances funeral by funeral, effectively as the people who hold to old discredited ideas die out.
Right.
And so this means that people, individuals by and large, don't have the incentive to sort of to abandon ideas, even when these ideas have been pretty comprehensively exploded.
Right.
What we need, I think, are sort of external structures that force people to reevaluate their ideas. And coming back to the argument about punditry, I think that's where a lot of the angst is coming in, that people like William Crystal, who clearly have been proved to be badly, dreadfully, egregiously wrong, people like Charles Krauthammer, you know, not only are they not sort of having to suffer for how badly they've got it wrong, in some ways they actually seem to be doing pretty well out of this. And here
that's absolutely right. And they remain kind of blissfully ignorant about the parts of the world they pontificate on, and you know, somebody like Michael Ledeen falls in the same category. And of course, those are people who are equally as reactive as a pure pacifist, since there don't seem to be any wars that they're against. And it's also, you know, I would like if one of these former liberal hawks would just, instead of saying I was for the war because blah, 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 so I believe something or other, some objective thing, they would just say, you know what, I was for the war because I wanted to seem like a tough guy. I didn't want to seem like a pansy, because that's what it really is. Ultimately, you know, our beliefs are, and that's not a terrible thing. We all, it's the way life is. I mean, I'm reading this new biography of William James, which is a which is quite a wonderful book. And you know, it's kind of like I think what William James's whole insight was about, how, you know, we believe what we believe because it's what we want to believe. It's what we choose to believe. It's what makes life work for us. And you have a model that is, you know, is based on certain assumptions about how politics works and how, you know, why your side loses in politics because you're not that, you're not tough. You have, it's built into your, whatever your, for all kinds of reasons. It's you want to be like those tough guys who, when there's a moral challenge, they stand up to it. They recognize it. They don't back down from a moral challenge. And it was presented as, this is the moral challenge. Either you stand up to Saddam or you back down. And people wanted to be on the tough side of that. Whereas in fact, as it turned out, the moral challenge was in being willing to stand up to the invasion.
Yeah,
and the rush to war. That was really where the challenge, as it turned out, happened to be. But I'd just love to hear that once, and those people should stay on TV or whatever. You know, keep getting the big speech deals.
A certain kind of humility is, that's really what's needed. And I know that people have different mileages on this, but I would be happily prepared to welcome back people on the right on the or on the left if they prepared to admit in that sort of way that this is.
That's true. I mean, I know it. I never crossed the line to being a liberal hawk, but I was certainly tempted by it because it was like, do I really want to be over here on the same side with, you know, Susan Sontag and Answer and all these folks? You know, you don't really want it. You want to be able to feel like you're on the tough, clear-minded, realistic side, because that sort of feels better. And I couldn't persuade myself to go over to that side, but I kind of thought about it, tried. That's how life is.
Well, the other thing which, and you referred to a few minutes ago, is the habit that a lot of people have when they're confronted with this kind of stuff of pointing to this or that bogus person on the other side of the argument, effectively finding the most stupid person who is adopting the opposite viewpoint and saying, well, you know, so people like this are the reason, they show that you can be wrong, right about this stuff and fundamentally wrong at the same time. And I think that there's a second kind of mental discipline which is important to have here, which is that you seek out the smartest possible alternative ways of framing the things that you're interested in, the smartest possible opponents, and read them, and you sort of go back and forth with them, and use them as your kind of as your sparring partners for this kind of thing. So that, for example, when I was reading stuff about the war, the people who I used to read on the other side would be Dan Dresner, Greg Jerigian, who has this interesting blog, Belgravia Dispatch. All of them, you know, sort of conservative, realist types of one sort or another, who clearly thought that the war was a good thing. But what I've noticed is that all of these smart people who I read for as people giving the alternative side of the story, all have come around in the last year or 2 years and basically more or less fessed up that this was a bad idea. I don't know if there's anybody out there who I would regard as being at all intellectually serious who still is pushing the idea that this was in any sense a good thing.
Right. Well, there's still the old incompetence dodge. It was a great idea, but how could we know they would implement it so badly?
Yeah,
which always was interesting to me. I mean, I think when I was thinking about this at the time, I remember there was one argument that you would hear, and I don't really know who I associate this with most, aside from a friend of mine in New York who would make this point a lot, which was the kind of like, maybe it's necessary to go over, maybe all this is necessary in some objective sense, but you can't trust these people to do it.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's actually, that always seemed to me a very troubling argument. Like, either something is right to do or wrong to do, and you have to, you know, to not have faith in your country and its leadership to actually do the thing that needs to be done puts you in a kind of bizarre position as a citizen, I think. So that if you decided it needed to be done, you should support it being done and just, you know, and hope that it's done well. But in fact, that was exactly the right argument. I mean, it was 100% the right argument.
Well, the person in the blogosphere who made that argument was Daniel Davies, who's now a co-author.
Yeah, that's. I just read a post by Daniel Davies recently. in part of this exchange that with Julian Sanchez, Megan McArdle on the other side, and Davies. That's really been quite interesting. Why do you think this has suddenly popped up? Why do you think we're talking about this right now? Because of the surge, or, you know?
I think in a certain sense, because the my guess is, and this is nothing more than a guess, is because the air has completely gone out of the balloon. There's, you know, nobody outside of the sort of genuine, nobody who doesn't have a job which depends upon saying what the president wants to hear actually seems to believe that the surge is going to happen. Right. Nobody who can be taken at all seriously as a sort of intellectual figure on the left or the right seems to believe it anymore. So in a certain sense, I think that this is a reaction to that. And we're seeing a lot of people, you know, sort of who are faced, I think, with the tough option, and I think this is what sort of Daniel was trying to do with Meghan McArdle, to put her on the spot. Well, okay, so you've admitted that you're kind of sort of maybe a little bit wrong about the Iraq war. Do you think that I'm sort of going in for this sort of last gasp effort of the surge is a good idea? So I think that this, you know, so really what it is it's a we're clearly in an endgame situation from one point of view, you know, which is to say that we're not getting out of Iraq anytime soon, but nobody who's at all credible believes that we're going to emerge from this with anything with anything that even resembles a victory, that the best that the U.S. possibly can do is effectively to not be forced out of there with its tail between its legs, that there isn't anything left at stake in that intellectual game. And so I think what we're seeing is a lot of people, you know, sort of basically trying to force those who have tried to maintain at least a position of strategic ambiguity on this kind of stuff, forcing them to fess up. And the other side of that was, you know, so if you saw Hillary Clinton for the first time a couple of days ago actually coming out and making a statement about how this was such a bad and a dreadful idea, and trying to get out a little bit ahead of the other Democratic senators in the vehemence of her opposition. And, you know, so that says to me that this is completely busted. You know, so it's basically George W. Bush, Laura, his dog, and Joe Lieberman, and I don't know if there's all that many other people apart from that who actually...
Yeah. Well, it may be the moment where this moves from being a present live debate about punditry to, you know, the question of history. It's kind of done, and kind of history will answer. It's kind of my daughter just got this little kid's biography of Jeanette Rankin. Do you know who Jeanette Rankin was?
I don't.
She was the first woman elected in her own right to Congress from Montana, and she was elected. I believe she was elected twice, not consecutively, from Montana, and she voted against both U.S. intervention in World War I and U.S. intervention in World War II. So she's sort of a pacifist heroine, and it's actually quite interesting. I think when you realize that, I remember in college sort of suddenly realizing that there was vigorous opposition to U.S. intervention in World War I. There was vigorous opposition to U.S. intervention in World War II. And both of them are kind of viewed by history as sort of wrong. But the World War I is a live debate, and the people who are involved in the, you know, on the other side, it was treated as a live thing. World War II, you're against that. You're kind of done. That was a kind of being wrong that history sees as not acceptable. And I think this is, you know, I think in the long run of history, it's just hard to imagine. You sort of imagine, you know, your grandchildren asking you now, who was ever for that? How could it have ever been that someone was for doing that? And it will be a very hard thing to explain. Colossally difficult to explain. I think it's actually difficult. I mean, I talked to some people who spent some time in Iraq. We had two people over for dinner recently who spent some time in Iraq. One in government, one in a nonprofit situation. You know, they both know a lot, and they were trying to say what. You know, they have no idea why did that happen. We all have our speculation. It just makes And I don't think it'll be any that much clearer to history, although I think history will have different answers about it.
Well, presumably, as soon as the administration finishes, we're going to have a bunch of people writing tell-all memoirs of one sort or another, trying to make sure that they were, or if not one of the rats to successfully flee the sinking ship, at least one of the rats which is best able to stab a few of its other fellows in the back and not take as much of the blame. That's a horribly mixed metaphor, for which I apologize.
Right.
Well, my tape is running out, so...
Okay, and we are at exactly 58 minutes, which is probably a good length. So maybe we'll do this again, talk about I've been writing some stuff about tax policy recently, so maybe we'll get Bob to let us do this again and cover all the rest of our topics.
Okay.
But we did talk about Celebrity Big Brother, which was my one and only goal here.
Well, tax policy we can return to. It's
tax policy
is
much more important than
Schmidt.
Celebrity Big Brother.
Yeah, and it's a fun article. It's a I'll briefly give it a plug in the remaining seconds. Basically, your argument is that we need to go for a big push on tax rather than incremental bits here and there because the politics of the situation are what's demanded.
You got it. Well, that's enough of an excuse to link to it.
Okay.
All right.
Sounds good to me. Okay.
Great to talk to you, Henry.
Great to talk to you.
Okay.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.